few points I want to say. First, if you really want to get a good background on what we're talking about tonight, there's two tapes of two events that happened in the same day this summer. This one I put in wrong.
Dan, you need a player. You can't just play them like that.
The first one.
Hey, Liz.
Come on in this corner.
Hey, Liz. Move over here with all the other
cats. This is Catholic area.
This is it.
We got to get it on.
First one I listened to today, I think it's marvelous. It's called The Augsburg Confession and Reunion with Roman Catholics by Walt Bowman, 56 minutes. And besides getting to hear this lecture, you get to hear Walt's little typical opening speech about his hemorrhoids. Do you remember? And I heard it three times, and then I heard it again today. Do you remember that?
But he gave that this summer,
yeah.
And he had just come, he's been a part of Roman Catholic Lutheran Dialogue for many years, and he had just come from the latest of those sessions, so that is about as authoritative stuff as there will be around in the whole church, is Walt Bowman on that issue right there.
More authoritative than...
No, I didn't mean it.
Until tonight. And the other one is, this happened the same day, this is Lutherans and Roman Catholics today, Paul Wee. Debbie's father, and he'll be here Thanksgiving. It'll be a good time to continue this discussion. He sat with the Pope, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. The Pope sat with him.
What? Walt Bowman.
The Pope sat with him.
And Walt Bowman, it's called The Augsburg Confession and Reunion with Roman Catholics. So I'll give these opening remarks and then we want to share. And this is a year where out in the outside world, just a tremendous amount of effort is going in this year to Roman Catholic Lutheran Dialogues. And in a way, it's too bad to be somewhat isolated from that. The Catholic parishes in this church are not too many, so we don't have too many to dialogue with. But I think we have three people that are Roman Catholic, right? Backgrounds, and that's why we can really, if you want to know who they are, I don't think you're embarrassed, are you?
Not yet.
Gemma and David and Liz. So it'll be a good opportunity for us to do some sharing from our backgrounds and how we see this. Hey, I just want to give a fast review of what's happened in the last 15 years. Largely, I won't review the whole Vatican II scene, which is really what opened this up to make it possible. When Pope John the 23rd and the Vatican Council started calling us separated brethren, and to show how things have moved now, the present Pope, John Paul II, calls us sister churches, which is even a step beyond saying separated brethren, sister churches. So that's one is a male program and the other is a female.
Grand improvement.
Yeah. As a result of Vatican II in 1965, Roman Catholic Lutheran Dialogue started and 20 theologians were appointed. In the United States, 10 Roman Catholic theologians, 10 Lutheran theologians, and they have been talking now ever since 1965. talking. Fascinating thing, they've gone through during these years a list of subjects, and they decided at the very beginning not to talk about two subjects because they would be too controversial. So these are the two subjects that they are finally getting around to talking to now and have just finished one or on the other. And there is so much agreement on these two subjects that they were afraid to even bring up to talk about at the beginning that Paul in his tape today said that the conversations are actually rather boring. And that was on Bible versus tradition and the doctrine of justification by grace through faith, they didn't think they could ever touch those two at the beginning. And now they're boring because all they do is sit and agree on those two subjects. But the progression of subjects, which agreement really has been reached, an agreement has really been reached on all of these. The first were easy, the Nicene Creed and baptism. Everybody was happy, no problems. Then the Eucharist as sacrifice, which if you grew up Lutheran, we used to always hear terrible things about that. Holy Communion as a sacrifice of Christ, a re-sacrifice of Christ. The theologians reached agreement on that, so we realized we could talk and agree on the Eucharist. Then an extremely difficult topic that followed that was the doctrine of the ministry. You know, who is a properly ordained priest or minister? Agreement was reached on this. Then very recently, and this made the newspapers maybe a year ago, that was very interesting, was one that would naturally be expected to be to be very controversial, and that was papal infallibility. And the theologians even reached agreement on these. Then the last two topics, justification by grace through faith and scripture and tradition, these are the most current topics in the dialogues, and they've almost phased out now and ended. And on all of these topics, there has been an area of agreement reached that would make it possible to say we agree and we can live together on all of these very major issues that separated Lutherans and Catholics at the time of the Reformation. Okay, now the other thing that's going into this whole area of Roman Catholic Lutheran dialogue now is that there's impetus in the fact that 1980 is the 450th anniversary of the Augsburg Confession. And an astounding remark was made looking forward to this year by the person in the Vatican who is the Secretary for Christian Unity. And he was giving a speech and made this very controversial remark that it is time that the Roman Catholic Church accept the Augsburg Confession as a statement of faith of the whole church. Now, where this comes as a bombshell to Lutherans and almost threatening is the realization that the promise of the Reformation at the time of the Reformation and when the Augsburg Confession was read and presented in 1530 would be 450 years, right? Thank you. I thought you were English, not math.
It was published in 1580.
Published in 1580?
Well, all of them together. The Book of Concord was published.
I see. Thank you for maintaining my dignity. I just have the two. Oh, 1580 they were published. 1530, the Augsburg Confession was presented. With the understanding that the Roman Catholic Church would accept the Augsburg Confession, which is a chief statement of faith of the Lutheran Church, that then there would be no need for a Lutheran Church. So at the point when the Roman Catholic Church is willing to say, we accept this as a confession of the Church, the Reformation is over. It's over. And then we all of a sudden we realize, my goodness, what do we do with our church? Okay, the second thing we know from the Augsburg Confession is that the confession says Lutheranism never was to be a church, never intended to be a church, but always intended only to be a teaching movement within the Western Church or the Roman Catholic Church. All the first Lutherans wanted was let us stay in and teach. So then the question now comes to us, what do we do? Okay, then the Augsburg Confession lists at the end, the first part of the Augsburg Confession is a fervent acknowledgement that we are good Roman Catholics. That's the whole first part of the Augsburg Confession, is proving to the Roman Catholics that we're as Catholic as you are. And that was the intent of the first part. The Augsburg Confession was a play, take us back in and let us stay. Second part of the Augsburg Confession, the last part, is seven abuses that the Lutherans at that time demanded that they be corrected in the Roman Catholic Church. As John mentioned in advertising tonight, six of these have been corrected. Six have been completely corrected. The only one remaining, the marriage of priests, there are even exceptions today in the Roman Catholic Church. The Eastern Rite Catholics, which are Roman Catholics, only use the Eastern Rite liturgy and are under the papacy in the Eastern world, have married priests. And this isn't advertised very often. Did you know that?
Is this Orthodox?
No, it's Roman Catholic. But they're called the Eastern Rite Catholics. And they're loyal to the Pope. They're under the Roman Catholic Church.
Primarily, I think
In Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
And also Holy Land, and also just scattered around the world. In major cities of the United States, I know in San Diego there's an Eastern Rite Catholic Church.
What about the Russian Orthodox? Isn't that included too?
Well, that's in the Eastern Orthodox Church. So these are groups that worship with the Eastern liturgy but are under the Pope. And therefore, they're organizationally, they're Roman Catholic. So these are some of the issues that. So I'm not going to say any more. If you want to know anything more about what I said, there are some here that know, or if we want to just talk a little about how we feel about this, how many of you hope you'll die Catholic?
Well, the ordination of women will pose another stumbling block for that. It's looking
for
that, and the Pope says
that's
not very likely. Kosher.
Yeah. Part of the thing is that we're pretty much talking about the correcting of Reformation abuses or Reformation problems of the 16th century. There are other new problems. Ordination of women certainly being one.
Is another new problem the infallibility of the Pope, or has that been solved, or what's the situation?
Well, how could they agree on that?
Yeah, what do you mean by agree?
Meaning the Pope is the person that can make mistakes? I mean, is that just the acknowledgement of that?
Yeah, okay. My problem is I'm not an expert on exactly how they came out, but I'll come as close as I can. Because this subject was dealt with in the... Hopefully. For those not in winter program, David tried to encourage us never to use the word deal with.
Hopefully. Watch him cringe. He just thinks Lawrence.
This subject was covered. And the conclusion of the subject in the Roman Catholic Lutheran Dialogues was maybe ended like a year ago. Where they came out was, now what both traditions did in these dialogues was, number one was go back to our roots, our common roots, our common heritage into the scriptures. When the Lutherans went back to their heritage, they realized Martin Luther was never against having a pope. He had all kinds of interesting words to call the current pope. He wants some good language. But he was never against, and therefore the Lutherans in the dialogue, biblically there's no problem with having a pastor of the whole Western Church.
An infallible pastor of the whole Western Church?
Well, see, now then the Roman Catholic side and the dialogues coming from their side convinced or explained to the Lutherans that the question of papal infallibility is really being reconsidered. You know, so therefore, the agreement, as I understand it, that was reached on this was Lutherans saying we'd have no trouble becoming Roman Catholic and having the Bishop of Rome being the head pastor of our Western Church. With the understanding that we would not follow the current, you know, the Roman Catholic doctrine of infallibility. Yeah. And the conclusion was that could probably be worked out.
When you say Lutheran, what are you including in Lutheran, like the Wisconsin Synod?
No.
You're not including them.
At this point, and this is a big problem in the Lutheran
Catholic. ALC, LCA, Missouri Synod, Wisconsin Synod, what others are there?
We're talking about 10 theologians that have been appointed by the LCA, ALC, and
not European Lutherans involved.
Oh, this is an American. I understand.
Well, I don't understand what the argument is. What is the infallibility of the Pope? I mean, what does it mean?
Oh, I can. Yeah, the other thing, the infallibility of the Pope was really moderated in Vatican II also. But first, what the infallibility of the Pope, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was the belief that when the Pope speaks ex cathedra, which means officially from the chair as the vicar of Christ or the representative of Christ on earth, anything he says doctrinally, cannot have any error. It's almost like a fundamentalism of the Pope, like a more Protestant fundamentalism of the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But he doesn't do it very often. It isn't like that happens every time. Last one was 15 years ago or something.
Yeah. Because
it isn't weekly.
My Pope John the 23rd was asked if he believed in that's on the tapes. He was asked if he believed in the infallibility of the Pope. And his answer was, I guess so, but I'll never use it.
Yeah.
Vatican II changed that or altered it an awful lot by again bringing to the church the understanding of the decision making of all the bishops.
That whole thing was horribly abused during the time of the Major Reformation.
Well, I don't think it was a doctrine then, was it? The infallibility of the Pope, I think, was
that's not mentioned in the Augsburg Confession.
No, that's a later development.
That's a later doctrine that was maybe 18th century, 19th century. No, Laura?
Three questions, and I keep forgetting them. But the first one was, how did they reconcile themselves on communion or the sacrament?
Yeah.
And another one was, Mary and her role and that how that compares with Lutheranism and it kind of goes along with getting more grace by doing things like saying your rosary and crossing yourself and how they stand together on that.
Okay, first the last, the main Reformation, you know, theme of justification by grace through faith. There really isn't anything to talk about. Most modern Roman Catholics simply agree, you know, that that's the biblical teaching. Go to the Jerusalem Bible, read their commentary on Romans, the Jerome Bible, the commentary on Romans, read Hans Kuhn.
I don't understand how come it is an official doctrine or it's official belief in the Catholic Church, isn't it?
No,
not official. It's rather like folklore. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of rosary and indulgence.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because a friend of mine who spent some time in a monastery in Washington said that he was taught that you do receive more grace by the fathers there. You receive, but see, the goal was just to love God, so that was just kind of an aside, not important, but that you do actually receive more grace or more time out of purgatory by
not
crossing yourself and saying your rosary and all sorts of things.
You're taught that, but it's like you're taught myth. In a way, perhaps I'm being heretical, but Catholic Church, I don't know, I don't feel that loyal, and I can't say that. But I was brought up in a convent and told that I had to recite numerous indulgences and give an N number of days that I would be out of purgatory. But for anyone who doesn't see things quite so literally. How can you time anything that's beyond time in number of days?
Well, that's an honor, but yeah. Does this whole Catholic Church say the same thing as you?
No, it isn't a hymn, it isn't a block. It's like I say, it's a folk.
Well,
it's almost like a
tradition or
a... Yeah, like a little nicety that you do.
Our priests aren't taught to do that and teach,
no.
And teach their foundation.
No, not at all.
Yeah, okay, and then for the other two, how about them?
Yeah, in fact, if you want to read some of the most inspired writings on justification by grace through faith today, you have to read them from Catholics, because they've recently discovered that. I don't want to...
Yeah, the other two.
Eucharist and Mary.
Oh, Eucharist and Mary. Okay, the problem of the Eucharist is I think what you're probably meaning, the problem that we were taught as Lutherans was that we were taught that Catholics believe that every communion is a re-sacrifice.
Well, that the body and blood were actually turned into the body and blood.
Okay.
Lutherans believe there's a mysticism about it, that it's kind of both. That's the way I thought it was.
Okay, where the agreement has been reached on that is really in the Roman Catholic Church as of Vatican II, you really have a transfer in the Roman Catholic Church from a Thomistic understanding of theology to a biblical, or you could almost say a movement from the Greek to the Hebrew, as we've been talking in our class, and transubstantiation was based on Thomistic theology, and which is more and more rejected in the Roman Catholic Church, and therefore when Roman Catholics today talk about the true presence of Christ in the sacrament, they they're much closer to the way we've usually talked about the true presence. In the dialogues, what the suspicion that the Lutherans had to break down is that the Catholics tended to think we didn't believe in the true presence of Christ in the sacrament. And also the Lutherans had all their problems with the sacrificial language. And then, so the document published from the talk, the dialogues, is called Eucharist as Sacrifice, where the Lutherans went back to the scriptures again and realized, well, we've forgotten all about that. It's a major theme that the Holy Communion is sacrifice. And it is it's an offering, it's a giving.
Can I try to explain something that helped me? Because I was really confused, as up until maybe still, about the whole issue of... Because I couldn't understand that if God was everywhere, why suddenly was he specially here in the Eucharist? I couldn't understand the point of it. But my sister explained it this way, and you can all either accept or not her little image, which was that, yes, God is everywhere, that's accepted, that's fine. But when you have a Eucharistic service, then God is present as a man. And it's as different as God being God and God being Jesus. And that's why it's special, because here on the Eucharistic table there's Jesus once more as a man, as flesh and blood. And that's special for us because of the immensity of God becoming man. And I find that really helped me a lot to understand it, because I was really hazy. Mm-hmm. But maybe you all have different interpretations, I don't know.
I've not heard it, but I like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mary.
Well, I just have sort of one dumb question. But do Catholics now take the wine in the Eucharist, or is that still...
Yeah, we do, but not all parishes can afford it. So it's sometimes, often they have silly excuses, either money or time. At my university, we had both bread and wine, and at most parishes we have it at Christmas time. Maybe it's different. Do you have it every time?
Yeah. That's Article 22 in the Augsburg Confession. I'm asking the Roman Catholic Church to give both the bread and the wine.
Sometimes they're just too stingy, or else they're broke, because Catholic priests have for money is the collection plate. They get nothing from the state. Sometimes they just can't afford it.
And the question about Mary?
Oh, about Mary. Yeah, the... Roman Catholics today are the ones that are really into biblical theology and biblical study are as I understand it, and have talked to, want to put the late doctrines concerning the Virgin Mary, just really put them on the back burner. And kind of say, let's kind of, and these are the Immaculate Conception and the Assumption, the bodily Assumption of Mary. And the, it was interesting in the tapes today, Paul said instead of our being critical about these, we should kind of try to help the, or, you know, not say, aha, because modern Roman Catholics really want to put those two doctrines that have been the most offensive to Lutherans, just put them on the back burner.
Does that mean they're ignoring them themselves?
Yeah,
they're just
ignore
kind of
them.
The books?
Mm, what?
Does that mean that they're just kind of there in the books, but they aren't really talking about them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, what the thing we have to understand about the Roman Catholic Church, and this is hard for us to understand, if the Vatican would announce that, like, the doctrine of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary is no longer a doctrine of the Church, all through the world you would have a rebellion of plain folk. And therefore we have to be sympathetic to that they would prefer not to just kind of put those, kind of put them off to the side. Is the a tremendous work has been published by Roman Catholics and Lutherans. It's called Mary in the New Testament. I think it's, I wonder if it's in the library yet. There, Peter in the New Testament was the first, and then Mary in the New Testament, in which Catholics and Lutherans went together to reevaluate the place of Mary in the theology of the Church, and came up, you know, what has come up in their understanding of Mary is beautiful, and it's, there's so much from understanding of Mary to enrich our tradition that we've really disregarded. Like it would be fun to spend a whole evening talking about Mary, mm-hmm. what she could mean to
us. There's a real nice chapter in the Merton book, Mysteries of Contemplation, on Our Lady Clothed with the Sun.
It's really good.
It
helped me a lot, too. I was going to recommend the same thing.
Okay. And the other thing was that Mary was a mediator. God, and I don't think that was ever official doctrine, and it's been pretty much...
That's what I wonder about.
Any priest I've asked about that, they just say that's wrong.
Oh, okay.
You know, Jesus is the only mediator between God and people, not his mother.
Well, what the Roman Catholics feel is that anything, if you pray to Mary, to Jesus through Mary, that he loves her with such a tender love, an undying love, that he can't resist anything that she asks. Okay.
When we talk about the Roman Catholic Lutheran dialogue and conversation, it's kind of like a giant and a dwarf talking to each other in a way, because Lutherans in the United States are only 10 million, and those 10 Lutheran theologians probably do represent a strong consensus in the Lutheran Church, at least theologically. So Walt Bowman and the rest of these people from the seminaries, they know each other on a first name basis, those 10 people. But the Roman Catholic side of the question is a whole different situation, because the Roman Catholic Church has 30 million members, and if 10 American theologians talk, they certainly are not representing 30 million Roman Catholics around the world. They're representing a small theological perspective here in the United States. So doctrines about the Virgin Mary will be taught one way at a liberal Catholic seminary here in the United States. They will not be taught that way in Spain or in Italy or in many other places. Mm-hmm. But just as there is a wide diversity within the Lutheran family, from Wisconsin Synod calling the Pope the Antichrist to Paul Weiss standing next to him in New York City, so too there is just as wide a diversity within the Roman Catholic Church. And we are a small group of people talking to a very large group of people. And so we need to keep a global perspective on the thing, and that is that Catholicism is a whole lot bigger than us, and that these conversations are really parochial in a way. They're just our neighborhood conversations. The 10 Catholics and 10 Protestants talking
here. Is that what parochial means?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's been narrow view.
Narrow and small.
Limited.
You know, it's a...
But it's much more... this year, it hopefully, is going to have a lot of effect because it's going to mean Lutheran congregations and Catholic parishes. You know, the real effort this year is going to try to bring this to the grassroots.
Yeah.
And the thing we as Lutherans have to always remember, and it's kind of a strange position to be in, that we are really Roman Catholics in exile. And our question is, how long does the exile last? Are we willing to give up our, was never meant to church, which has become a church? Are we willing to return to the Western Church?
I'd like to know more about that. I'd like to know how you feel.
How do I feel, or how do
people feel? Because I feel more Lutheran than Catholic, and I've even been here like 2 months. I wonder if everybody is an adaptable.
Let me take a position of saying I don't want to do that, and then maybe someone else will figure out that they do. What to say that seems to me to put some kind of an aura over some imagined line of historical development, to say that the Western Church is some church body associated with what we define Roman Catholic Church. Why do that? I mean, why not say that we're in the Western Church? We are in the Catholic Church. No one owns that word Catholic. It simply means universal. Why do we have to go anywhere? I mean, we could continue the talk. I'm all for that, absolutely. Is this merger viewed as the way to formalize the end of the talks? Would that be it? Or what does it mean for us to join, to get back in the church, in a sense? What does that mean? Is it simply an end of the talks, maybe?
Maybe it means having one church in a parish as opposed to two.
I take it as meaning that Lutherans would be called Roman Catholics. They wouldn't be called Lutherans anymore. And they would be Roman Catholics.
See, Roman Catholic itself is a term of division.
Yes.
Because there are other Catholics around too, like the Eastern Orthodox. I mean, each term we have amounts to a sectarian kind of a term.
Mm-hmm. Just Catholic and universal.
Mm-hmm.
But then
do we have to go anywhere to do that?
Another way of saying it would be that we are already home. Where is there to go?
Mm-hmm. That's something of what I'm saying, and yet I sense that there is some particular reason why some folks are saying, you know, for us to get back together, and I wondered what that would mean.
Well, I think the greatest thing that could happen to this humanity would be if we were all one Christian church again. You know, I think that we basically see that scriptural teachings as one teaching, and all the sectarianism is the way human beings have botched up over the centuries the teachings of the Bible. It's as if in your own family back home, every one of you had a different last name, you know, and as if you weren't really members of one family.
I didn't.
In other words, I see that there's a danger in our seeing each other as Methodists and Lutherans and Baptists and Roman Catholics as if we were different from one another and believed some basic things differently. I think we all believe that the important basic things, the same things, alike. And the most pleasing thing we can do in the eyes of God would be to embrace one another as one family with the same name. I'd feel better about it. I'd be delighted to be a Catholic.
It seems like what that does is, by bringing Lutherans and Catholics into the same family, there's an opportunity for dialogue, just like what is happening. when we're in the same family together, if I include myself in my family, there's a requirement, or there's a, well, requirement for dialogue. I need to be in communication, and I think that's what would, that process of becoming one would help that to come about. Instead of splitting and saying, I will go someplace else, I remain within and say, I will talk. I will try to work this out with you, amongst us. And
I think we all recognize that within any given congregation, the congregations we are in back home or the congregation we create right here, that we don't all believe exactly alike. There are differences of interpretation and habit and belief about some factors. And if we want to make sure that people who don't believe exactly alike have a different title, a different family name, like Methodist or Baptist or Lutheran, why, we could have a million different sects.
I think, you know, we already have the advantage of the diversity of belief within the congregation, as you say. And when we join with the Roman Catholics, it's when we'll stop talking to them. The talks will be at an end at that point, because there won't be anyone to talk with. I think it's a great advantage that there are Roman Catholics and Lutherans, simply because those are two traditions then that are still in dialogue with each other. And, you know, and the mutual benefits, I suspect, are great and probably will continue to be for some time. And I think it would be very bad if we tried to hurry the process. It's like, you know, it's like a love song that says, take your time about falling in love. Don't be in such a hurry to get, you know, to the end point, because it's so much fun along the way. And I think we'll have a lot of fun along the way with the other, you know, churches, as we learn to know who they are. And in its own proper time, I think the union will happen without us pushing it.
But 500 years isn't very much of a hurry.
Well, that's... But time looks strange to us because we're only going to live maybe 70 years. But, you know, that doesn't mean a thing.
Thank you.
No, it shouldn't, though.
Well, I mean,
but should or shouldn't, and does or doesn't.
I mean, we're doing okay. As you said, Jimmy, you've got everything you want. You don't need the union of the Catholics and the Lutherans to fulfill you in any way.
I benefited from teaching. I think the Lutherans are a teaching sect in the Catholic Church. And Catholics are missing out.
I'm plugging for that. I'm saying let's continue to talk.
Now, if I could clarify something that most people who envision this happening maybe in 50 years, you know, would see the Lutheran in the Roman Catholic Church is still a very distinctive entity. You know, there are the Augustinians, there are the Franciscans, there are all kinds of different things whirling around the Roman Catholic Church. You'd also have a Lutheran order. You know, there in no way would identity be lost.
What is the advantage then? What's the reason?
The advantage, okay, the two is going back to the scriptures, you know, the prayer of Christ is the unity of the church, and that, you know, everything we know about the Hebrew mind, unity never means a spiritual unity floating around up in the clouds. It means bodies being together. You know, that means organizations, institutions. Secondly, when Lutherans and Catholics dialogue, it is not, and if we're going to be true, if we're going to say we're the Church of the Augsburg Confession, that is our promise to be true to that, to be authentic to that. And if we are authentic to that, the very essence of the Augsburg Confession is that this is a document by people who want to be back in the Roman Catholic Church, to be a teaching body in the Roman Catholic Church. In other words, we're not talking about two separate churches. We're talking about the Western Church, you know, which is the Roman Catholic Church. People who follow the Augsburg Confession really, historically, are a teaching movement within that church. And the question of history, will this teaching movement be allowed to operate within the confines of the church, in which is really its mother?
That's, I think, the important point, because I just really think the Lutherans have some valuable insights, and Catholics don't get them. I think we're looking out.
So in other words, the union of the two would not be the end of the talk, it would be a step further into the talks.
It would be like the grain inside a pearl. I mean, it has to scratch up to get the fruit. Mm-hmm. It would always be like an irritant, something challenging in there. Mm-hmm. It would be helpful.
On a mundane kind of level, from the grassroots probably, is how wonderful I think it would be if people could go from being Lutheran to joining or going to a Roman Catholic church without having the term convert, or vice versa, mm-hmm. without that word convert always.
And being able to take communion.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, so that I see it as education in both groups so needed, so that people in the parishes have, first of all, tolerance for each other, which hasn't always mm-hmm. existed in the past, mm-hmm. and then, mm-hmm. you know, understanding, going beyond, first of all, being tolerant.
Would it be envisioned, would there be something like, we talked about other Lutheran bodies of establishing altar and pulpit fellowship, for example. Would that be a step on the way to this kind of a getting together?
Yeah, I would guess, and you know, unless some real historical thing happens, that will be seen in our lifetime. Mm-hmm.
I say about the kind of progress that it takes, or the time that it takes for groups to get together, that I'm a pastor of the ALC, American Lutheran Church. That antecedent bodies were ELC, AELC, and some others. And it started in 1956, the conversation. Took 12 years, anyway, for the American Lutheran Church to be formed. And the ALC came into existence in 1960. 12 years of conversation before that time to unite Danes, Swedes, and Norwegians, whose biggest difference was lefse, meatballs, and you know, stuff like that, and some other things. But you know, it took 12 years for that to happen. And now what we're left with in the United States are 10 Lutheran synods. Wisconsin, Missouri, ALC, ALCA, and six others. AELC and some others. I don't expect to see this in my lifetime. I expect to see altar and pulpit fellowship. But I think it's really unrealistic to think that it's going to happen.
There already is in parts of the world.
Yes.
Yeah. Altar and pulpit fellowship between Catholics and Protestants. Sorry.
I have a real trouble with talking about the church as an organization anyway. Like, I was talking to Gemma at dinner the other night, and she said that she prefers to just call herself a Christian. And that's unrealistic. I know that there's going to be divisions, and I think it is getting better, because my mother, when she was little, it was terrible if you went out with a Catholic, and if you ever married a Catholic, you know, how awful. But now, here's my sister and I, my sister, you know, half the time goes to a Catholic church, and sometimes she goes to Assemblies of God church, and she belongs to a Lutheran church and goes there most of the time. And there's no problem for her in that, even though she, you know, she was going to call herself something, she would be a Lutheran. And so it almost seems like there, it's irrelevant whether, for her, whether she's called a Lutheran or a Catholic or whatever. But I can see the good points in calling everyone Catholic too. But isn't that leaving out an awful lot of other Christians? I don't know. I'm not saying anything or just wondering.
Yeah. How would that leave people out, Lori, by the two churches?
Well, there'd still be the Catholics, but then there'd be the Presbyterians and the
Methodists.
But is that not for each denomination to work out with?
The point is, hopefully, that you're a Christian, I'm a Christian, and then we can start from there, because, as you said, each individual has their own personal kind of views of, you know, in relationship with God as it is. Sometimes it seems irrelevant, and sometimes it seems like it'd be a really neat thing.
Yeah, I suppose in a way we're talking about hundreds of years of, and we have to kind of start with where we're closest, you know, and as Lutherans we're closest to the Roman Catholic.
I always think of the problem just between the ALC and LCA and the Missouri Synod. For a while there, the discussions were real thick and they were going to kind of combine or whatever, and then I think it was, and I can say this from the Missouri Synod, kind of botched things up and threw a wrench into things had some things that they wouldn't go along with the other two churches. And that has broken them up. And I coming from my church, I guess I feel, hey, it would be great if we could all become Catholics or join. I think it would be a great statement of faith. But I look at my church and I say, hey, there are some people, they're not based on scriptures, it's based on, hey, we're not going to join that because we're not going to become Catholics. We're Lutherans, you know, and that's all there is to it. And that's their argument, period. And I can just see the obstacles there. It might split the church, at least in our church, I'm sure it would.
Excuse me, Karen had her hand up.
Well, I was just wondering, the Lutheran Reformation sort of formed the basis for most of Protestantism. Isn't that kind of right? I mean, I realize Calvin and Wesley and these other people.
No, there's a real difference between Lutherans and other Protestants, and this even includes Anglicans, and is that all the other Protestants chose to leave the church. The very document that is the foundation of Lutheranism is a plea to let us stay in.
Okay. Now, that's so very different. The other Protestants stand over against the Augsburg Confession. That is not their confession.
No, it's only the Lutheran church.
That is the definition of Lutheran, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the definition. In fact, some places in the world, the Lutheran church is simply called the Church of the Augsburg Confession. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing that makes the...
So that answers my question. I was wondering, where do the Anglicans and some of these others stand in this dialogue and what's going on?
Yeah, the Anglicans, because they're similar to the Catholics, are doing their own discussing, you know, their own... Yeah, David?
I think of it in terms of Jesus presenting us over and over again in the scriptures of his vision of the kingdom of God and his request that we try to establish as close to that kind of a model on earth. And I think of, here's where I may sound naive, but I think of Jesus coming again, of us suddenly facing our God, and he's going to say, my children, what have you done with my kingdom? You know, we're just going to be hanging our heads in shame, and what can we explain what we have done with the purity of the scriptural teaching? And that's why I get impatient. You know, I don't think I've got a single reason that would stand up in the face-to-face with God to explain why we are in so many different sects and churches, and that we should move forthwith to get back to what I think is the vision which he presented.
What commission is that we establish the kingdom? What are you speaking of there? What references are those?
Well, I don't have particular ones to quote. What I'm thinking of is the parables of the kingdom, you know, of a banquet where all are together equally, and that this is what the kingdom of God in heaven will be like. Teachings of Jesus are to do likewise on earth.
I mean, it seems to me like the kingdom is a found thing. The pearl, the treasure, or it's a thing that grows by surprise. You know, it's leaven that kind of sneaks through the dough. It's, and it seems to me like it's a found thing. And my difficulty with what you're saying, I think, is that it makes it seem as though it's something that I have to do, and that puts me in immediate despair. I cannot, even if I'm certain that I have the truth of a matter, as soon as I, in my certainty, approach my brother or sister, it's only antagonism and it isn't love, because it's me somehow raising myself over my brothers and sisters. I mean, I've done that so much, and it just doesn't work.
It might help that biblical scholarship today sees, has corrected an old notion that the church is the kingdom. You know, and what you say is right, but the biblical understanding is that the church is here to reflect the kingdom, or the community on earth where it is almost like a foretaste to the kingdom, where the values of the kingdom are put into practice in an institution here on earth. And at that point, then the disunity of the church becomes an embarrassment, if not a heresy.
The high priestly prayer from John
is
certainly more so than the parables, I think.
I can't quote it.
That they may all be one. That phrase, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's
as we shit. As we are one.
As, yeah.
Yeah.
That the,
yeah.
That all, everybody may be one.
Mm-hmm.
That
and,
is
and again, if you follow Hebrew thinking, that doesn't mean some kind of a spiritual.
No, it doesn't.
It means bodies.
Right. I think, you know, I think my experience, for instance, in the Canadian town where I was, and we had meetings of the pastors in town, and the Roman Catholic priests were in that, and the, what would be the Canadian, would it be Anglican? Yeah, Anglican was in Canada, and the United Church and so on, there are some other mixtures, but they have similar roots to ours. And I felt a good deal of identification with, for instance, the one particular Roman Catholic priest. I mean, just personally, I did. In fact, I stopped by one day when I needed some counseling, you know, to talk with him, because I couldn't think of anyone else in town, really, that I would rather talk to right then. And I think, you know, maybe those kinds of things are happening in the face of this other problem that you mentioned of, you know, the great diversity that we're talking about, trying to pull together. And yet sometimes in those meetings of pastors and priests, it was impossible for us to do one thing. Because somebody would say something and say, you know, I'm sure we can assume that we can do this. And three people or 5 people would jump up and say, now wait a minute. No, you can't assume that. I can't go along with that, you know. And I mean, you'd be so surprised, particularly if you were the one who thought that we could all agree on it, you know. It's really tricky.
Let's see unity as something that happens when the Pope comes to Iowa. And it's not a committee meeting, and it's not theological discussion. It just infects Iowa. It just happens. And you cannot plan it, and you cannot program it, and no amount of study books will make it happen. You know, as opposed to Lutheran unity, which is plodding, careful, theological, committees. Everybody goes to Holiday Inn and flies in Western Airlines, you know, talk about it. But as that kind of unity, as opposed to the kind of kingdom unity, which is an event, which is a surprise and a miracle and a yeast in the dough, and it happens, and there's two ways that unity come about.
You know, one of these tapes said a beautiful thing, that maybe God is moving the church towards unity because we have such hard times ahead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can there be unity and still be tradition and individual church body? Can't there be unity in the sense of the high priestly prayer? We are all one in Christ, but still underneath that have national traditions and individual church bodies?
It's just as the body has fingers and
you know, Stringfellow in his book says that one of the problems with American churches is that so many of the indigenous American churches were formed out of the American culture. And he says they hardly have their roots in the Pentecost event. They are hardly connected to the Pentecost event. You know, some particular church begins 1,000 years or 1,800 years after the Pentecost event. It just begins, you know. And it isn't rooted where it should be, he says. Although there are people in those churches who are, but as a church body. So maybe sometimes we do hold on to our traditions and our language in that a bit more than we really ought to. It's a curious kind of a thing. I think if Lutherans and Catholics got together, how would we look at Presbyterians? Presumably we would say that they believe in Jesus Christ. I mean, how are we going to relate to them in the event?
Part of the...
I just think that sometimes the church structures are more of a hindrance than a help. And we're all assuming, each one of us, that we have the whole truth. Which is crazy, because none of us have the whole truth. Every one of us sees it partially. If we could just relax and realize that each church has a partial truth, you know, just let them get on with it.
Oh, we all need each other.
Yeah, we all need each other. Yeah. If being a Quaker is the way that you are, then why try and be Catholic or Lutheran? If being a Catholic is the way you are, I get bothered. As Catholics, I was told that we are the one true church. And I thought it's so obnoxious of us, I always found it difficult to say that. But I think maybe all churches say that in their own way. And it just seems so pig-headed and such a barrier. And as Karen was saying, how can you keep up? It's a bit like nationalism. It gets exclusive sometimes. So long as you can be open to everybody else, then I think that we should just relax and just get to know each other and not try and convert, as someone mentioned.
Yeah, it's part of, I think, it's kind of a living faith that the final unity of the church is the work of the Holy Spirit, not our committees.
Mm.
And how it's finally going to happen is probably going to be so different than the way we've plotted. And the,
yeah. Look what happened when Jesus came. I mean, the Jews just... It wasn't the... Was it?
No, this will be a heavenly surprise.
I think what you just said is really... was really a heavy remark about God is bringing us all together because of the hard times that you're going to be coming.
Very well.
I really think it's us who are working toward the unity, and that's why it's so slow. Because we're doing it through our committees and so forth. I don't think we're really... If God were taking hold of Christian unity, it would happen in a lot different way and a lot faster than we are working it out amongst ourselves. And I think that it's really our slow action that is carving out this little bit of unity out of the mess we have.
Are we doing it in a Greek way and now we're doing it in Hebrew?
Yeah, but I
think
that's
how.
I had an
experience of what it would mean for our congregation. The congregation I used to serve in California, it was the littlest church in town, 200 members, just a tiny little Lutheran bunch downtown, in the middle of downtown, and our home was some miles away, and right across the street from our home was a Roman Catholic congregation with 4,000 members.
Mm-hmm.
They had 4,000, we had 200. They had two priests, and 6-7 services a Sunday, and a neighbor right next door came over one day and said, one of the priests just called and asked me to do education. What do you mean? Well, they called and asked me to do education in the parish. And she said, and I got this from a friend of mine, and it was a Book of Mormon literature on how to rear a family. And she said, do you think I should use this over at St. Justin's? Oh, I was sick. Because here was our little 200 member parish downtown. Over-educated, over-trained, over everything. I mean, we had a Sunday school with 30 students and 15 teachers. You know, and if we start a new project, we'd fly 5 people to Los Angeles to get trained for it. It was just intense. And we were sick because we had so much education and nobody to do it on.
Yeah.
You know? we were just nauseous of each other because we were all overtrained.
Mm-hmm.
So we were kept looking around for anybody who would take our program, but they all had their own running. So here was this 4,000 member church out there and two desperate priests. But our congregation had a lot, we lacked a lot, we had no Chicanos. And we didn't know how to do piñatas or anything in our little church. You see, we had all sorts of stuff we didn't know how to do that they knew how to do. But I had a vision from the Lord of our 200 people doing just education. You know, and it could work. It really could have worked. It would have been beautiful to sell up the thing downtown and to join St. Justin's, and it would have been a happy marriage. And then the 200 of us could learn. Could
exactly, because we're a teaching movement. That's
yeah.
That's our identity. That's
yeah.
So I was one almost time to quit. I hoped, and maybe we could do this again, to be fun to dialogue kind of on our personal journeys of moving from prejudice. You know, I grew up with fantastic prejudices. My father... thinking he was so tolerant when he would tell me there will be some Catholics in heaven in spite of the church. You know, we all probably kind of grew up with some of these. And, it'd be fun to share those sometimes, also for those with Roman Catholic backgrounds, you know, what's it like to be in a place that's just kind of swirling with Lutheranism, you know.
My sister wrote the other day and says, a little P.S., this is my elder sister who used to be a nun, really straight lady, she's 40, and sort of bakes cakes for the Women's Institute, and she wrote and said,
sort of.
Long letter saying how happy I found it. And P.S., what exactly are these Lutherans teaching you?
Is that the exact words, Jim?
Yeah. And that's the whole thing. P.S., didn't even dare put it. She wanted to put it first, you could tell all the way to the
next. David, you said refreshing.
Yeah. It just the idea of talking about this openness, all of it. Talking about having access to the Bible. I think that's becoming more prevalent in Catholic churches, but it's just really refreshing to be this close to it.
Yeah. What I'd really like to know about the Lutheran Catholic dialogue is whether the Roman Catholics have agreed to eat lutefisk.
Oh. You know, there's a nitty gritty right there.
Yeah.